Podcasts of Homegrown are made possible thanks to support from listeners like you. Consider becoming a member of WFPL by calling 502-814-6565 or at the website wfpl.org. Thanks. Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
I'm Bob Hill.
And today on the show, there's definitely a hemp theme, I would say. We're going to head out and visit Farmington, where certainly what you see there today is a fabulous historic house. They've done a lot of work on restoring the gardens, so we're going to highlight that. But I think a lot of people didn't realize that one of the mainstays was hemp production at Farmington back in the day in the 19th century.
So. Or the role hemp played in Kentucky agriculture and history and culture.
And just the uses of hemp and how, why it was so valuable, in fact. So we'll be visiting Farmington in the second part of the show, so you'll want to stick with us. But first, we're going to talk to Deb Alexander, who's a Louisvillian for part of her life.
Part of her life, yeah. And she worked on a doctoral dissertation on hemp growing in Kentucky and slavery and the violence that ensued when the hemp industry died out. Very interesting woman and has a great deal to say about hemp and production and the cultural, social, and economic problems it caused. Within slavery and the whole history of Kentucky.
Yeah, I mean, and you know how I love this. It's the whole sort of interdisciplinary look at something. Nothing happens in a vacuum or for one reason.
Exactly.
You know, so she can really pull in the different pieces that reflect the whole situation of why hemp died out in the end, how violence against blacks after slavery ended, how that was all connected. So a very, very interesting story, to be sure, that unfolded here in Kentucky back in the late 1800s.
Right.
Yep. All right, Bob, what's going on in your garden these days?
A couple things. One quickly thing. I'm still dealing with the ice storm. We had a limb fell just this past couple weeks.
Like a hanger that just finally let loose?
A big limb. Uh-huh. I mean, it was like probably 25, 30 feet. Mm-hmm. And it tipped all the way over, and it was at right angles to the tree and the ground. Nobody was underneath it.
Thank goodness.
Just a little warning to people.
It ain't over.
It ain't over, especially to get some more windstorms.
Yeah.
On a brighter note, I tend to always think when people ask, what's the best time to see flowers in your area, in your place? And I tend to say June. But I've changed my mind. Mid-May is the best.
Things look beautiful.
It's just utterly astounding. Mm-hmm. I mean, the lilies, the campanulas, the baptisias, the fringe tree, the roses, the clematis. Just this chorus of beauty. So I'm just going to push up to mid-May when people ask me.
Yeah.
What a great time.
It is. Yeah. And it's even been a cool season. So it's not like things, are fast-forwarded by any means.
It's one of the best springs ever. I said that last year. Then there was a six-week drought, of course. So.
Yeah. And other things,
How about the Wishy State? What's up?
Well, as you can notice, probably, my voice is a little scratchy today.
Well, you've been singing too much.
No, I actually had to scream at the top of my lungs yesterday. My mom has this new little dog, and this new little dog has a little terrier in it.
No.
And when she brings him out, she keeps him on a leash because we're still trying to figure out what the deal's going to be, right?
Yeah.
So, we're down and we're weeding and that long perennial bed down by the lake. And I have one chicken that she just goes and does her own thing. So we had let little Dewey off his leash and we were watching him and he was being good. And then we didn't know that one of the hens was underneath the pine trees.
Oh, no.
So he knew, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So he takes off after her. She's running up the hill towards the barn, right?
Yeah.
And I take off running. I felt like a 1,000-pound elephant. I felt like I couldn't run fast enough. Yeah. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
And I'm running uphill to boot.
Mother
and
Wishy.
And mom's, mom's screaming and running. I'm running, screaming at the dog, no, And the dog catches up with the hen and grabs tail feathers. And then she gets away.
Yeah.
And then, it's this wave of, and we're all yelling and screaming and running. And then Andy's coming and I finally get to her, and the dog does not get her, thank goodness. She's scared. I pick her up, and I hold her for a while, and that helps calm her down. And then I've come to find out that Mom, as she was running up the hill, she fell down.
Oh, no.
So, if you had a bird's-eye view of this whole scenario, it would have been extremely entertaining. But because I had to scream at the top of my lungs for 30 seconds, I'm a little hoarse. And I have to say, it was extremely traumatizing. I told Mom not to worry. She is not the sum of her dog's actions. She's still invited out. But, you know, dodged another bullet, and Dewey's going to have to stay on the leash.
That sounds both scary and cartoonish at the same time.
Exactly. And just that feeling that you have. I literally felt like I had concrete feet. I couldn't get there fast enough. It was awful.
I'm laughing with you now.
I know, exactly. Not you have, and to thank
and
goodness
your mom,
she's okay.
Yeah.
Exactly. And mom didn't hurt herself falling down in the grass. So that's the chicken trauma. Hopefully we're done for a while.
You need to write a book about raising chickens.
I don't know.
A year with Miss Wishy's chickens.
Which, yeah, there are some funny stories in there, to be sure.
I guess.
All right. There are some events going on around town. One to quickly mention, because we'll talk about it later when we visit Farmington, but they're going to have an evening in the garden event. It's going to take place June 12th, 6:30, where they're going to honor Wendell Berry. And then you'll also be able to see what they've been doing with the garden. So that'll be a pretty cool event, June 12th. But we'll talk about that later. A couple garden tours coming up, Bob. The Glenview Garden Club garden tours Saturday and Sunday, June 6th and 7th, from 10 to 5, rain or shine. And Crescent Hill garden tour is Saturday, June 6th, from 9 to 5. Of course, you can go to our website to get more information on all those events and find out about ticket sales, etc.
Yeah, the Louisville Rose Society is having its first ever Rose Garden Tour on June 7th. Six Rose Gardens will be on tour. All the gardens were award winners. Tickets will be sold on the day of the show from the parking lot of St. Leonard's Catholic Church. For more information, again, go to our website, WFPL.org. And also, there's a rush of farmers markets back home again in Indiana. This is kind of neat.
Yeah.
Jeffersonville Preservation Station right there on Market Street. Tuesdays from 3 p.m. to 6 p.m. Saturdays from 9:30 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. Charlestown on the Square, Thursdays 3 p.m. to 6 p.m. New Albany, the corner of Charlestown Road and Blackiston Mill Road at Sam's Food and Spirits, Saturday mornings from 8 a.m. to noon. And finally, the corner of Bank and Market Streets in New Albany, Wednesdays 4 to 7 p.m., Saturdays 8 a.m. to 1 p.m. For more information on all those markets, again, go to our website at WFPL.org.
Yeah, I think all the farm markets are open by early June. So if you know ones in your neighborhood,
farm
go
markets.
To it.
It's great. Yeah,
and also the 6th annual Blooming Bardstown Garden Tour is going to take place. It's Saturday, June 6th as well. Rain or shine, 9 to 4. Starts at the Farmers Market Pavilion. You can get your tickets there and all that. Other festivities, of course, are going to be going on. So check out the gardens and the farm markets in your community every weekend from probably now till October, I'd
say. Buy local.
Buy local.
And eat local.
And, you know, you might even be able to find some hemp products at some of those places.
Actually, you could, yeah.
I got a nice hemp hat. It's like a pretty little linen hat. It's fabulous.
Yeah, I think somewhere online I've got some too, or Janice got either one. Mm-hmm. But for more information on this kind of stuff, we're going to speak to a woman named Deb Alexander. She's a former Louisville resident who's working on a doctoral dissertation on the growing of hemp in Kentucky, including the Louisville area and around Farmington, of course, and in the early United States, and the use of slave labor to grow and process the hemp. She's with us today from her home near St. Paul, Minnesota, to talk about her work. Deb, welcome to Homegrown.
Hi.
Yeah, first, we know you got some Louisville background, so tell us about your background here and then how you got involved in the hemp story and the growing of hemp.
Actually, I grew up in Evansville, Indiana, but we moved to Louisville when I was 9, and I finished high school at Sacred Heart Academy, which you might know in Louisville.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
But I got my undergraduate degree in California, and one thing led to another. I worked in journalism, magazine and newspaper journalism there, and was a film critic for some years in Los Angeles, but I moved to Minnesota to take a job as a film critic at the Pioneer Press in St. Paul in the late 80s. And when I stopped doing that and got married and had a kid, I ended up deciding to go to grad school. And I attended the University of Minnesota, where I also worked full-time. And so I kind of went to grad school in my spare time. But I got a master's degree in history. And when it came time to decide on a dissertation topic, I became interested in risk factors for violence during Reconstruction after the Civil War in Kentucky.
Huh.
And I found this entirely unknown story about the end of the hemp industry, which had been tremendously important in the bluegrass in the early part of the 19th century.
Mm-hmm. Let's back up a little bit, and before we get to Kentucky, kind of set the stage for hemp in the United States. Was it grown in Europe and then the colonists bringing it here with them?
Actually, it was grown, it was a popular crop in the late 18th century in the early colonies, and many households grew hemp or flax to spin into cloth to be used as household cloth. The first hemp in Kentucky was raised kind of commercially near Danville in 1775. But before that, it had kind of been a household staple, and people grew it so that they had, they spun thread and wove cloth from the thread that they made. Of course, once hemp became a large-scale crop, slaves were needed for the commercial production, and it was a very important crop in the early 19th century. Do you know who John Wesley Hunt is, by any chance?
Well, sure.
He was postmaster of Lexington, appointed by John Adams, and between 1803 and 1816, he had a hemp factory in Fayette County. I mean, he did other things. He bred trotters, and he speculated in land, and he dealt in slaves. And but it was really the beginning of his great wealth. And hemp is always mentioned in Kentucky history. Even Henry Clay talks about his neighbors' manufactories for hemp in his defense of the American system in the 1830s. But by 1839, Lexington had 18 rope and cotton bagging factories, which was the major commercial production in hemp, and it employed like 1,000 people in wow. Lexington in the middle of the century.
Give us a snapshot of what a hemp plantation, you know, how it would work, what it would look like, you know, what was necessary to actually grow the actual plant and then process it into some sort of fiber.
Well, you know, it's interesting. There was a novelist, James Lane Allen, who wrote about hemp at the turn of the 20th century in a book called The Reign of Law.
Mm-hmm.
And he actually has a very poetic way of describing hemp. It was very much a product of the bluegrass and very much synonymous at that time with the sights and smells of that area. It could grow 12 feet tall.
Mm-hmm.
Some agricultural writers talked about 18-foot tall hemp.
Wow.
That was an inch in diameter, and it's a crop that was supposed to grow very straight and close together. It was a kind of hemp that's sometimes called China hemp, not, you know, marijuana as we think of it today.
Right.
But these were grown on plantations of hundreds of acres, and when James Allen writes about this, he has a poetic way. If you would like, I could read a quote.
That would be fabulous, please. Yes.
He says, 100 days to lift out of those tiny seed these powerful stalks, hollow, hairy, covered with their tough fiber, that strength of cables when the big ships are tugged at by the joined fury of wind and ocean.
Huh.
And now some morning at the corner of the field stand the black men with hooks and whetstones, the hook, a keen, straight blade, bent at right angles to the handle, 2 feet from the hand. Let these men be the strongest. No weakling can handle the hemp from seed to seed again.
Mm-hmm.
I guess you can tell from that quote, hemp took a long time to grow. And one of the reasons that Kentucky was a good place for it was that it was an annual cycle, so mm-hmm. that hemp would be planted in late March, early April. Seeds would be cast, and it would grow until the first half of October. They would cut it with these knives. They sometimes call them corn knives,
mm-hmm.
and they'd set this up in loose shocks that were kind of teepee shaped and left to dry for a couple of weeks.
Mm-hmm.
After that, they were spread on the ground to be what they called dew-retted or field-rotted,
mm-hmm.
and that would break the woody outer part of the stem away from the fibers. They would then set it back up in shocks, and then at the very end of the year, in early January, in the middle of winter, they would do something called breaking the hemp, where they would crush the stems and release the fiber.
Mm-hmm.
And they do that all the way from January through March, and then this cycle would start again.
Wow. So, Deb, it's always fascinating to think about who kind of first figured out that a plant was useful in any given form, right? Whether it was food or medicine or mm-hmm. fiber. You know, what's the history of hemp, you know, and it first being used as a fiber? Like, who kind of figured out the whole process, do you know?
Well, as I say, it was traditional. It was a traditional home, household, domestic chore.
Mm-hmm.
And the colonial legislatures actually offered subsidies for people who would grow it.
Uh-huh.
One of its main uses was for rope, which when you think about an agricultural economy run by horses and mules,
rope extremely is important.
Uh-huh. But it became very important in Kentucky as an industry when it was used to bale cotton. You know, the invention of the cotton gin meant that they had these bales that needed to be wrapped.
Okay.
And for a very long time, they were wrapped in bagging made of hemp,
mm-hmm.
which was kind of a rough fiber, and they were tied with rope until the Civil War. There was some need for protection and tariff because starting in about the 1840s, there began to be competition from China and India, where gunny sacks started coming into New Orleans by boat. And
what were the gunny sacks made out of?
Well, I think mostly jute. There were other fibers that were from the Pacific and Asia.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, as I say, China hemp was the preferred hemp because it kind of grew without leaves. It just grew mostly stem and very, very tall.
Uh-huh.
Well, Deb, were there big factories that would process the hemp into cloth, or was this done pretty much by individual homes?
Well, that's kind of an interesting question because the early hemp manufactories weren't industry the way we think of industry today. The rope walks, that's what they called them, were actually places where the hemp fibers were plaited or braided into ropes of different thickness. They would have different numbers of strands.
Okay.
And it was kind of a... the way they have pictures of this process, and it's really people walking back and forth in a very set direction and attaching new fibers to fibers that were ending as they braided them. So it was very early industry, but it was it made people quite wealthy in the bluegrass area because there was this large and growing market for hemp. The thing that it's real important to note is all this happens at the same time that there's an import-export business in slaves. And so slaves are also being sold down the river along with the hemp.
Mm-hmm.
And I know you've heard of Thomas Clark, who's kind of the dean of Kentucky history.
Right, absolutely. Yeah.
Thomas Clark. He talked about this relationship. He talked about hemp being a mainstay of slavery, and conversely, slavery was a mainstay of hemp growing and processing. And he thought that perhaps slavery would never have gotten a hold in Kentucky without hemp.
Mm-hmm.
One of the reasons that hemp dies as an industry with the Civil War is that suddenly there's a labor crisis.
Huh.
And since the Civil War, you know, ended slavery, it also devastated the Kentucky hemp industry because the industry depended on this slave labor to grow and to break the crop.
Mm-hmm.
I found an incredible letter, in fact, in 1850 when Kentucky is reinscribing the relationship of slavery in the Constitution at that point. There are some real discussions about this. William Bullitt talks about if we take away slaves and we don't have slavery, you're going to destroy the production of hemp, which he says is bound to make the rich lands of Kentucky and Missouri still more valuable.
Mm-hmm.
And you understand, too, when you read letters from the time, how very hard the work of hemp is if you're not used to it. There's a hemp farmer's son who's talking about the sort of physical agony of this work, and he says, "Pa has taken up the notion I don't exercise enough, so two or three Saturdays ago, he put me to breaking hemp that wasn't half rotted. I thumped hard all day and got 25 pounds, and you never saw a poor fellow in as bad a fix as I was that night." He talks about not getting over his first attempt at breaking hemp for two or three days, and he says, "Since that, I have preferred plowing." So this was incredibly hard work that was labor-intensive, and they did not have a machine that could break hemp as well as a trained, experienced man.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look in the Kentuckiana Digital Library, you'll find photographs of this process of black men in the fields with these handbrakes that are made of wood. So from the industrial standpoint, it seems kind of primitive, and yet huge fortunes were made from this crop.
So ultimately, that's the difference between hemp plantation, slavery connection, and, you know, to the South, indigo or cotton, because technology advanced along with those products where it simply didn't with hemp.
Yes, and I would say there was another difference. Cotton had a way of depleting the soil of nutrients.
Uh-huh. Right.
And so you needed to continue moving ever westward. In Kentucky, where hemp was planted for generations, you know, John Wesley Hunt grew hemp in the early part of the 19th century, but his grandson, who becomes the quote-unquote thunderbolt of the Confederacy, has a hemp and bagging factory generations later. Hemp could be grown successively on the same plot, particularly in that rich limestone soil, without depleting the soil of nutrients. So it allowed for this... when James Lane Allen talks about this world of hemp, he's actually valorizing something that's lost by the time he's writing. But he talks about it in this very pastoral, nostalgic way because it lasted for such a long time. It was a worldview. And when that ends, one of the reasons I look at it as a precursor of violence is not just because there's the statistical connection, but because you can see how this world ends for people who have, you know, grown up with their fathers and grandfathers expecting that they would have wealth in the land. And there's this matrix of connection between the wealth of the land, the wealth of ownership of slaves, the wealth of ownership of the crop, and all that dies in 1 minute.
Yeah, we'll talk about the violence part in a second. I'm curious, you mentioned the rope walk, and I've seen pictures of those. Describe for our listeners what that looked like, because it was just a building 100 yards, 200 yards long, where they just literally walked the rope and wrapped it and braided it, right?
Well, again, there were different kinds of manufactories, and they were mostly urban. The Louisville and Lexington were really centers for hemp processing, which would be grown in like the hinterlands around them. And my understanding of this process is that it was actually mostly, at least up until about 1880, it was mostly done by skilled hands who knew the way that you walked, you tie the hemp at one end, and then you'd pull it, and you'd wrap it, you'd braid it or plait it, and then new pieces of hemp would be added as you came to the end of the piece of rope. There was a lot of competition until 1850 with Russian hemp, which was done a different way. It was called water-retted or water-rotted, and it was whiter and brighter and cleaner looking than the domestic hemp. And it was actually, Henry Clay never got his wish. The American Maritime really used Russian hemp. And I think that was processed differently. There was an attempt to bring water rotting into Kentucky, but it didn't work out. It caused too many deaths, actually, because the slaves who were working on that new technology, quote-unquote, got pneumonia, and there was such loss of labor that they stopped trying to do it.
So then come the Civil War, and, you know, and slavery changed and everything changed. Is that when the violence kicked in during the Reconstruction era?
I don't know if you're familiar with the research of George Wright.
No.
He has written a book, really the book, on racial violence in Kentucky. And one of the things that he discovered looking at this subject was that it goes under a broad heading of lynching, but it kind of doesn't really look like lynching after the Civil War. It's more like the war is continuing and there's a lot of guerrilla violence. But in any event, he talks about the number of deaths of this kind. Really, a third of all of them take place in the very first 10 or 15 years after the Civil War. It was an incredibly violent time, and it's a time when things are changing very much for ex-slaves, many of whom are also veterans of the Union Army, who are coming home and reclaiming their families and wanting to farm for themselves and perhaps grow more subsistence farming. Mm-hmm. You know, you look at that, there's some very interesting newspaper called The Colored Representative at this time, and it's centered around Fayette County, and they're talking about what any agricultural group is talking about. They're talking about shorthorn cattle and fruit trees and mm-hmm. basically subsistence farming.
Sure.
And you have on the other hand, former slave-owning whites who are losing their labor force, who are incredibly unhappy with this political organization. Mm-hmm. And I can recall an example that Wright talks about in 1872, when a whole family is lynched, and you know, signs are hung on them to say we're doing this because of the political organization. Mm-hmm. So it's a dark chapter.
Right.
But one of the things I have to say I found interesting is statistically the correlation is with hemp as a percentage of agricultural production and not as a percentage of wealth. In other words, I think a lot of the violence is correlated with people who are not wealthy, but they're mortgaged to the hilt.
Right.
And there's a boom and bust very quickly in the hemp economy between 1866 and around 1872, where people who are mortgaged suddenly find that they can't pay off this expensive land that they've bought.
Mm-hmm.
So I think what you're seeing is the end of an era, and for a lot of white farmers, they can't make a go of it.
So then hemp disappeared for a long time. I think somewhat not ironically, but it's coming back now as a consideration for fuels, for biomass, that kind of thing.
Well, you know, hemp has its ups and downs because after the First World War, states were enacting laws prohibiting growing hemp for things other than medicinal and industrial fiber purposes. And you know, that's kind of the demonization of reefer madness.
Right.
But then when World War II comes around in 1941, federal authorities don't have access to these Asian sources of fiber, and they're trying to revitalize hemp, and particularly Kentucky hemp. So the need for the fiber and the availability of seed and all those things increase, involving the USDA and the War Board. So they come up with a new industry, and eventually the industry disappears again after the war.
Right.
But then in I think 1970, there's a tax from the 30s that's repealed.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, nowadays people are talking about, and some states are passing laws for marijuana, that kind of hemp, being available to people at the end of life, again, as a medicinal mm-hmm. medicinal tincture. So, I don't know, it's gone through a lot of changes.
But let us be clear that the fiber hemp is completely different than the marijuana joint smoking type of plant, right?
Yes, you know, I like to think about, you can say pine tree, and that can mean a lot of different
exactly.
things.
Exactly. Thank you very much.
The subspecies that was used in the 19th century is, as I say, one that's supposed to grow without leaves or flowers,
okay.
which waste good energy that could go into the stem.
Uh-huh.
And my understanding of the other kind of cannabis, or cannabis, however you say it, is
uh-huh.
you mostly want flowers, right?
That's what I hear. All right, Deb, thank you so much. We appreciate your historical insight into hemp in Kentucky.
Great.
Very interesting. Former Louisville resident Deb Alexander has researched the growing of hemp in Kentucky and in the early United States. For more information on hemp or Deb Alexander, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org.
Coming up after the break, we visit a real historic hemp plantation, Farmington. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL. Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
I am Bob Hill, and we are standing in the place of history, Miss Wishy.
We are indeed, and it's looking better than ever, I have to say.
It does.
We're at Farmington, of course, just off of the Watterson Expressway. We're going to be talking with Andrea Pridham and Holly Smith. They're both here with us. Holly was the principal designer during the restoration of the Ann Bruce Haldeman Garden, sort of a redesign. We'll talk to her about that in a bit. But first, let's get our sorts about us when it comes to the history of Farmington. Andrea, you're the executive director out here, and she's in her work clothes today because she's also a gardener out here, I suspect. But can you give us a little background, the story of the family, the story of the plantation, all the work that's being done, and kind of bring us up to speed in terms of where we are today?
Sure. Farmington Historic Plantation was completed in 1816. The construction of the main house began in 1815 for John and Lucy Speed and their family. The majority of the labor, of course, was done by enslaved African Americans here at Farmington. The Speed family occupied the home until it was finally sold off entirely out of the Speed family hands in 1865. Farmington was a 550-acre hemp plantation. That was their primary cash crop for many years. But they also produced a variety of other vegetables, produce, etc., things that not only sustained the family, but they also sold at local markets. One of Farmington's most important elements of its story is, of course, the issues of the Civil War, and particularly the connection that the Speed family had to Abraham Lincoln. Mm-hmm. Lincoln was Joshua Speed's, that's John's son, Joshua Speed's closest friend for many years, really until Lincoln's death. Not only that, but Joshua's brother James also served as Lincoln's attorney general in his second cabinet. So the rich stories that we have to tell here at Farmington involve these issues about slavery, which of course was at the forefront, the main issue of the day during the Civil War, very much an issue for the Speed family. The Speed family was slaveholders. They were slaveholders, which is what makes this relationship with Lincoln so unique and so compelling, is that Lincoln and Speed were able to maintain this friendship despite these terribly opposing views on slavery. But yet the Speeds were also very pro-union. So it really brings to the forefront all of these issues that we can talk about when we talk about the history of the Civil War and this time period in American history.
And just off to our right is about a third of an acre of restored garden we'll talk about later, but tell us briefly the history of the garden and bring us up to date before the restoration began here.
Well, this garden in particular that we will be talking about today is not historic in terms of this site in the 1830s, 1840s. We do know the Speeds would have had many different types of gardens throughout this plantation. This one in particular was designed by Ambrose Haldeman, very well-known Kentucky landscape architect. But it was installed in actually the early 60s, I believe, shortly after Farmington became a house museum and was saved. And in fact, Haldeman, a lot of local folks don't know this, but Haldeman was responsible not only for this garden, but in really spearheading the effort to get a group of people together to save Farmington in the 1950s. Haldeman's design was based on the notion of what would have been here in the 19th century. There were no plans. Plans don't exist now, at least, in terms of really letting us know and defining clearly what Farmington's gardens would have looked like. Over a period of many years, because of a dwindling volunteer base, lack of financial resources, et cetera, things like invasive plants, the garden really fell into a pretty bad way. And over the last 12 months, due to some major fundraising efforts that we've been doing, we were able to first secure a grant with the Gaines Foundation to get started on the garden. So Farmington already had Hope Gardner from Boone Gardner as one of its board members. So we went to Boone Gardner and said, this is what we'd like to do, or what can we do, what should we do? And the project started from there. But the project was only 50% with the Gaines Foundation, and Boone Gardner was able to secure the remaining 50% due to their generous donation. But we had to really look at issues of restoration versus redesign. That was a really tough issue, and I think a lot of historic sites really go through this process when they're looking at any project. And we had to make some tough decisions.
And you're also going to be honoring another Kentucky legend, Wendell Berry, as part of this process. Talk about that a little bit.
Yes, we are. Well, Farmington is thrilled that on June the 12th, we are honoring Mr. Wendell Berry with the Ambrose Haldeman Award. The Ambrose Haldeman Award, which I'm sure both of you are familiar with, has been, I think this is the 7th or 8th year for the award. And that award is evolving. I think typically we have sort of stuck specifically to honoring garden design or garden champions. But I think given Mr. Berry's dedication to saving our cultural heritage, our resources, preservation not just of houses or sites, but also of areas. And I think it's really appropriate along that philosophy that he be receiving this award in Haldeman's honor, because she also stood for those same things.
All right. Well, so let's get down to the garden. Holly Smith is here with us today, and she's a landscape designer with Boone Gardner, part of the matching of Boone Gardner in terms of getting this project done is your work, Holly. So thanks for coming out today and talking with us as well. So you have a little bit of a kind of personal connection to your work here in the garden. Can you tell us about that a little bit first?
I certainly can. My mother, who has been involved in historic gardens for her whole life, since she moved to Kentucky in the early 90s, was running the volunteer group out here taking care of the garden. And it was a passion for her. So even though I didn't live in Kentucky at the time, I've been hearing about Farmington Garden for years. And in the past 3 years since I've been down here, I would come down here and help her. And just kind of, I heard a lot of the things they struggled with. They had some really bad invasive weeds in here that they just couldn't get in on top of. But I also saw her love of the garden and the beauty of it, you know. And so it was so meaningful for me to be able to do something to in her memory, because she passed away in 07.
Holly, where do you begin to restore a garden like this? The beautiful brick walkways are still here, and the squares are rectangulars, like I say, covered a third of an acre. But you're beginning from scratch. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, I mean, Ambrose Haldeman's quadrants are, you know, that's sort of the framework. And that really sets up the garden room. And the other idea that we wanted to do is keep that hedge, really make a garden room. But the lilacs, as I was saying, were really suffering. And we, because of this increased shade, we decided to redo the hedge with viburnums. We decided we wanted winter interest. That was one of the main changes that we made, in the sense that we put in the boxwood. We looked at the Ambrose Haldeman plan and really tried to keep a lot of the same plants and sort of do the design in the spirit of her design. She had sections of the garden planted in vegetables, very linear, gooseberries and asparagus, and lots of areas that sort of spoke to the kitchen garden that would have been part of a historic garden. So what we tried to do was to make an ornamental garden that reflected those design principles by planting linearly to sort of keep the historic spirit.
However, you've chosen plants, and that's sort of what Andrea was talking about, the challenge of, is it restoration or redesign? Mm-hmm. Can you highlight a couple of the plants that you've chosen that ultimately are superior because they're available to us today and they weren't available to us, you know, back in Ambrose Haldeman's day?
Yeah, absolutely. Of course, we have Annabelle hydrangeas, limelight hydrangeas. We've got the Roseanne geranium, which will just give a long season of color here. We did roses that are disease resistant. We did the knockouts, the blushing pink knockouts, because one of the challenges here, as we say, is that there's very little staff to maintain it. It's volunteer. So we wanted everything to be able to really pretty much survive with very little care. So we did a lot more, proportionally a lot more woody material. We put Caryopteris in for late summer color because of all the events things. We really want this garden to look beautiful from the beginning of the season to the end of the season. So, but we also put the historic plants in there. We put the Dicentra. We put the Spectabilis, the Bleeding Heart. We put the Bath's Pink Dianthus. The old variegated iris. It's just an ancient variety. The peonies. So there's kind of a blend of the old and the new. The crab apples. Crab apples are, you know, this particular variety is not an early one, but crab apples have been around for centuries. Yeah. So they're, it's kind of a blend of the old and the new.
Well, I especially like you replace the lilacs with Jedi Viburnum, and there must be 50 or 60 of them, where the fragrance is going to be phenomenal. Yes. When they kick in.
It's 84, actually.
Oh. I meant to say 84. I'm sorry.
And then in front of, once that hedge does become a hedge, in front of that, you've got the order of the Nepeta, or the catmint, that, you know, is going to be fabulous as well. So there's a very linear, sort of traditional style to the garden, but a more updated sort of plant selection, if you will.
Yeah, I was trying to strike a balance. You know, I think the whole quadrant layout, it's very sort of static, mm-hmm. but we wanted to play with that, and we used the boxwood on one end of each of the quadrants. But on the inside, we used a linear planting of lamb's ears and a linear planting of ladies' mantles to kind of create that frame, but be a little softer. And then the plantings that we did in the middle, they're sort of linear, but not strictly all one in a row. There might be a group of three, and then in the same line, there'll be a group of three, so that it's a little bit looser. And when everything grows, it'll be very full within the framework of the boxwood.
So, Holly, is there a plan, other than the fact that you've chosen plants that should do well on their own, is there somewhat of a maintenance plan kind of set in the future? Because that's ultimately the challenge of, you know, any sort of job like this, whether it's our own garden or something associated with Farmington or a public space. Is there somewhat of a plan in place?
No, volunteers are still already coming out and working on it. The mm-hmm. two volunteers that were that knew my mother and were very involved when she was living, and I think we're in the process of putting together a plan. We will be in the next few weeks so that we can provide what it needs. You know, water, of course, that's this first season is going to be our biggest challenge, and just making sure that things get established, and then whatever little pruning and deadhead and that kind of thing. But it shouldn't need a whole lot. Really what it's going to need this first season is water and weeding and that kind of thing. So
it's also a great setting. You've got some massive sugar maples here and a hackberry and some nice dogwoods. And I'll remind people, we're only about 30 seconds off the Watterson Expressway. You just get off the Watterson and Bargetown Road. You go north maybe quarter mile, and there's
a
big sign that says Farmington. And I bet you thousands of people go by here every day not having a clue what's here. So get off the expressway one day, folks, and come smell the roses off Bargetown Road in Farmington.
That's right. You can certainly get a little inspiration from the new garden, but you can also go to our website where we will have photographs at wfpl.org. Holly Smith, thank you very much. We appreciate your time.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
And Andrea Pridham, thank you.
Thank you.
Good job out here. Holly Smith is a landscape designer with Boone Gardner and the principal on the restoration and redesign of the Ann Bruce Haldeman Garden here at Historic Farmington Plantation. Andrea Pridham is the executive director here. Farmington will be hosting a special evening in the garden honoring Kentucky author Wendell Berry on June 12th. For more information on that, on Farmington, and all the plants here in our visit here, you can go to our website at wfpl.org.
Coming up next, a few listener questions and Miss Wishy's new Latin Word of the Week. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL.
Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
I'm Bob Hill with two wide-ranging questions.
All right. It is question time on
yes,
the show.
Yes, it is. And this one's from Carol.
Okay.
And this is actually is kind of a fun question, but there's a lot of people have the same issues maybe. I recently bought two small azaleas, about half-gallon pot-sized each. I wondered if I could plant them together in the same hole to give them a larger look. If not, how close or how far apart should they be planted? Thanks.
I guess you could, but I don't think it's a good idea at all.
No, I don't either, especially if they're different colors.
Well, and it's just like you don't allow either plant to reach its full potential because you're going to crowd it in. And
exactly.
It's not a good idea. You know, for an annual, maybe, because it dies at the end of the year, but not for something that you want to live for a very long time.
And azaleas are a little tricky anyway in that they have mm-hmm. really this massive roots and they need a little room to grow and mm-hmm. got to keep them watered.
And they're kind of shallow rooted.
Exactly.
So if you plant them together, they're going to compete with each other for the moisture, the nutrients. Then you have the problem of if one of them dies, you know what I mean? And it's just going to be kind of an ugly scene. And it'll be lopsided because they'll be growing, you know what
exactly.
I mean? Yeah. So not recommended.
Yeah, last fall, I planted a bunch of azaleas and rhodies I got at a sale at the end of the year at nurseries. Mm-hmm. Oh, my goodness.
And they're doing really well.
Oh,
spring.
Boy. Yeah. Heart-stopping stuff. Yeah.
So azaleas, in my mind, plant them in a location where you get morning sun.
That's what I got.
Shade from the afternoon.
Underneath pine trees.
Perfect, because they like slightly acid soil, a lower pH.
Are they happy?
And in terms of how far to plant them apart, Carol, it really depends on what kind of azalea you have, because some are going to get really big. Some are going to, you know, be a little smaller, depending on the cultivar. If they're a pretty standard size, the big size, I would put them, gosh, at least 5 feet apart.
Yeah.
You know, in terms of letting them reach their
maximum. It's hard to do that at that size, but that's what you got to do.
But plant other things around it for now.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? Other shade plants. We talked to Jean Bush last couple weeks ago. There's some great shade plants that would set the scene really nicely, you know, in that same sort of environment. Some Solomon seal, whatever. And that'll give you interest the rest of the year,
She'll be glad she did in a couple of years.
Exactly.
One more question, Miss Wishy. Since you're on a roll here, I'll read it to you. It's from Gary.
Gary.
He has a mature Harry Lauder walking stick, which is the contorted filbert. They're, they're neat plants. I have one myself. Not paid much attention to it, however. How should I go about pruning or shaping it up to look its best? Is it necessary to wait until fall or colder weather? It seems pretty tough and healthy and not struggling. Thanks for your thoughts.
Well, you're a pruning king, too. It is best to prune woody plants when they're dormant, and it's also just kind of smart because you can see the structure of the plant a little bit better. So pruning in February is always fun in my mind.
Exactly.
Gets you loosened up for spring. If you have to do some pruning, you can do it anytime, really, but I just wouldn't do any heavy pruning.
Exactly.
If something's dead, prune it out whenever, you know, kind of general rule of thumb. Also, another general rule of thumb when pruning, you never really want to remove more than a third of a woody plant at one particular time. So if you need to do a little shaping now, go ahead and do it, but then wait for any major pruning in the winter months.
Yeah, especially the Harry Lauder, because it's got such big leaves, and it'll cover the reason why you bought the bush in the first place.
I mean, it'll cover the pretty
the crooks and the curves and all that stuff. So it's best done in the fall or early spring when you can see what you're saving, because it's more of a winter plant to me anyway.
Yeah.
I love it in the winter.
And then when you make your cuts, just never make cuts that like chop off the arm in the middle. You know what I mean? You want to go back to where branches, you know, meet other branches, or stems, you know, meet other branches, that sort of thing. It's called the branch collar, that place slightly out from the main, a main stem or
like
a branch.
Like a singles bar. They meet each other there.
And then just visually, it's like, Bob, what's your thing? You make three cuts, step back three feet.
Yeah.
3 feet. Make three cuts, step back 3 feet, you know, to sort of size it
up. Maybe 6 feet the second time.
Yeah,
and then 9 feet. No, literally.
Yeah.
And walk and around
eyeball
it.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Because you can't get it back on there once you get it off.
You can't. Exactly.
You know, you can get some help from God, but you cannot do it yourself.
That's
Elmer's glue will not get it. If you have a question for Bob or Janine, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org. Email us at homegrown@WFPL.org or call us at 814-8246. Well, Miss Wishy, your Latin word of the week is absolutely perfect for this, what we've endured this spring.
Do you know what inspired me? I was helping my friend do some stuff. She's about to have a baby. So I was potting up some plants for her since she was, you know, had her mobility's limited. Literally, she's about to have her baby.
Yeah.
And they live in a relatively new house, and I was pulling up some dead dogwood trees.
Oh.
And I pulled them up, and it was like, and you look in the hole, and there's like water standing. So I thought, we need to find out what plants are going to do well in this boggy situation.
Yeah.
So the Latin word of the week this week is limosa, limosus, or limosum. It means of marshy or muddy places.
It's amazing. I've never heard of this before. I guess I should have.
Mm-hmm.
I think of limousine again, but who wants a muddy limousine?
Yeah.
The L-A-M-O part.
Yeah.
Limosa.
Limosa.
What a great word.
It's not a breakfast cocktail.
Or a drink,
Carex limosa, mud sedge.
Mud sedge, indeed.
Hitter anther, limosa.
Blue mud plantain.
How about that? Mud. I'm a mud plantain.
I'm proud of it.
This is a cool Latin genus. Legionnaire.
Legionnaire.
Legionnaire,
mademoiselle.
I guess. Legionnaire limosa.
The false Venus's looking glass.
Mm-hmm. Plantanthera limosa.
Thurber's bog orchid.
Yep. An orchid that likes muddy
And Mr.
feet.
Thurber, apparently.
Yeah. Colima limosum.
Jelly lichen.
Jelly lichen. Polygonum limosum.
Muddy polygonum.
Muddy polygonum. Exactly. Polygonum does well anywhere, really, doesn't it? So, yes, if you have a marshy or muddy place, like a lot of new construction, look for limosa, limosus, or limosum, because likely that plant will do well, especially after a wet spring like we had this year.
Absolutely.
Uh-huh. Well, that ends another edition of Homegrown. Next week on the show, our friend Tom Barnes and some rare floral finds in Kentucky.
Homegrown is produced by the never muddy Brad Yost in the studios of WFPL. I'm Bob Hill.
And I'm Janine Wishy. Join us next week for Homegrown on WFPL.